Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I added two words to the title, as you can see, non-equilibrium, just to make it a bit clearer what I'm going to talk about. Well, we heard yesterday from Peter Wierenga and Jirka Simonek about the topic of non-equilibrium flow and transport modelling. I also went into the Web of Science before coming here just to confirm, and of course I'm not surprised by this, none of us will be, that this topic was really one of Rean's big contributions. Four out of his all-time top 10 cited papers are in this topic of non-equilibrium flow and transport modelling. And that's saying a lot as well when we look at how highly cited he is. So I won't need to go into too much detail because Peter and Jirka talked about this yesterday, but the mobile-immobile model and analytical solutions of it, the numerical dual permeability modelling, Horst later will talk about that, I'm sure. Not least developing and disseminating and supporting user-friendly software like StanMod and Hydrus, where those concepts, non-equilibrium flow and transport concepts, were incorporated. So that's been one of his big topics in his career. Another one, as we heard yesterday, and Johan Baumer was talking about it, for example, is support for parameter estimation. That includes developing databases like UnSoda and methodologies for parameter estimation like Petter transfer functions. So what I want to do today in my talk is actually try to combine the two to see whether we can, if it's feasible, to develop Petter transfer approaches for these non-equilibrium flow and transport models. In other words, can we go beyond model calibration? Because initially that's all we could do with our models, really. Calibrate the parameters. Can we see beyond that and try to use the models predictively? The first thing to say about that really is that macropore flow is, we all know, if we concentrate on macropores now as a one part of this non-equilibrium transport set of processes, that macropore flow is a fast non-equilibrium pore scale process. So we have a problem really here, it's an upscaling problem. Because we to be able to predict, we need to be able to find a link, really, between the pore scale, where the process is taking place, to a larger scale where we can actually observe or measure something. So the question really is, does soft or hard data, soft information, hard data, at the PEDON scale, carry enough information on macropore flow to enable us to predict? And that's what I'm going to look at a little bit today. Just one qualitative example, I think, that this picture I've been showing the whole time, I think, is a good illustration. to suggest that this should be feasible, really. This is a silty clay soil outside Uppsala. It's been under permanent grass for about 50 years, at least. And it has a humic A horizon, which has a very fine crumb structure, which has been developed through earthworm activity, actually, over many, many years, bioturbation. It has very dense rooting as well, and a high organic matter content. Below 8 centimeters, then you go into this B horizon, which has a strong, blocky structure. The roots only grow in the interaggregate pore space, and there are a few earthworm channels as well. And you can see that the morphology of the soil profile really is showing up in the transport pattern that you observe in that dye tracing experiment, that you have rather uniform flow in that bioturbated topsoil and strong macropore flow along these interaggregate pores in the B horizon. So in this particular case, there is a very clear match between what we can see, observe, measure at the profile scale and the transport process that we get. There have been, oh, I should go back there. How do I go back? Yeah. There have been attempts to develop Petter transfer functions for parameters in these models, these non-equilibrium models, that are model-specific and or site-specific, that individual parameters individual models for a certain area have been developed. So that again shows that it should be feasible to do this. But what we're after really is more of a generic approach, that you can develop some kind of model-independent generic approach that can be applied everywhere, in principle, with any model. So what we started out to do then was to try to develop a conceptual model of macropore flow that would really be based on the consideration of the factors that affect soil structure formation and degradation. So it goes a little bit back to what Ty was saying about soil physics trying to integrate here with other disciplines, because this has to be interdisciplinary if it's going to work. You need to have an understanding of soil biology, chemistry, pedology, and so on. Link that to the soil physics. So this conceptual model really is looking at structure forming and degrading processes and how they are influenced by fundamental soil properties like texture, organic matter content, climate, topography, and of course land use and management, a very important part of the whole business. Traffic compaction, cropping systems, and so on. What I'm going to show you is just really a first stab at this, and it will be necessary to refine and extend in the future, I'm sure. So what we came up with really is a classification system for susceptibility to macropore flow, in which each horizon of a pedon or a soil profile would be classified into one of four classes, from going from no potential for macropore flow to very high. And the idea then is that that classification could support class pedo transfer functions principally, in which you could link the parameters of a model to those four classes. You could also use this for more qualitative risk mapping or vulnerability mapping as well, where you don't actually do any quantitative modeling but just map risk across an area, a landscape. I'm not going to have time to go into the reasoning behind this. This classification takes the form of a decision tree, as you can see. I haven't got time to go into all the details of it, but it's in that paper that's coming out in Vado's own journal very soon, I hope. It's been in the pipeline for some time. But you can see that it really is based on information that is available from soil survey, in principle, and land use, information on land use as well. And there is thinking behind that, even though, and it's in the paper, but I won't have time to go into it here. So you can see there's a separate tree for topsoil and subsoil, and then questions to be answered that will lead you to a class in each case. But I've got no time to go into the details. But what I can do is show you some results of applying it anyway. So this is going back to our example, that picture I've been showing all the time, to show that at least in this one case, qualitatively anyway, it works quite well. Because if you go through those trees, you end up with that upper 3 centimeters being class 1, 3 to 8 centimeters being class 2, and the B horizon class 4. So, and the dye tracing pattern would seem to fit quite well with that. But that's not going to convince anyone, so we need a more quantitative test. So we have done a first effort at trying to, well, validate is perhaps not a good word, but to assess the accuracy of this approach. What we did was we went into the literature and tried to find as many short column tracer breakthrough experiments under steady state flow that we could find, a data mining exercise. We had rather strict selection criteria to ensure that we could get as similar initial and boundary conditions as possible amongst all those different experiments. Because, of course, the initial and boundary conditions have a very, very strong influence on the breakthrough curve that you get. That was brought home to us very strongly when we did this exercise. So we could find, in the end, only 52 column experiments from 13 studies and 22 soil types and in 5 countries that really had similar experimental setups. Then what we needed was one kind of preferential flow indicator to characterize those breakthrough curves. And we looked at time moments, it didn't work too well. So we ended up with a very simple indicator of preferential flow, and that was the pore volumes drained at the peak concentration as an indicator of the strength of preferential flow. And then we compared that with the macropore flow class predicted from that decision tree, extracting the information from the papers on the soil properties and so on, and the land use and so on. And these are the results. You've got along the bottom, you've got the macropore flow class, 1 to 4 here, and up the side, the indicator, the pore volumes at the peak, drained at the peak concentration. And what you can see is that there is a rough trend in the right direction anyway, that these are class 1 soils. They shouldn't have much macropore flow according to the model, and they end up with an average around 0.9 pore volumes drained at peak concentration. So classic convective dispersive transport, more or less. Each one of these letters is an individual column, and so the M letters there are from the same study, but they're different columns. That's what those are. So you can see a trend going down towards very rapid breakthrough of the peak in class 4, but there were only 2 columns there, so that's not particularly convincing. The overall model is significant according to the p-value here, but we only explain about 30% of the total variance. So of course there is a lot of scatter. You can see that, especially in this class 2. It goes from way up here to way down here. There are reasons for this scatter that you can identify by looking at going back to the original papers. You can see that these two up here are cases where there was clearly anion sorption going on. I think that's the case for those two. So there are reasons for some of this scatter. One of the main reasons for this scatter in class 2 is illustrated here, and that's the texture in this group 2 really is medium textured soils often. And if you look at for this group, look at the pore volume, the peak concentration the pore volumes drained at peak concentration as a function of the clay content in this group, you can see quite a strong relationship there. So a lot of that variation is sort of explainable. That's what I'm trying to say, in terms of texture in this case. So the whole thing looks quite promising. But we obviously need a lot more testing, and that will surely lead to more refinement. The scheme is really supposed to be generic, but at the moment there are situations and cases that will not be covered by the scheme, and those will hopefully be hopefully we can account for those in the future. We want to test it more with designed experiments rather than data mining as well. We're doing that now. But it does seem that there is a significant degree of predictability of macropore flow at the scale of what you might call mappable structural elements like soil types or land use classes, which would enable you to make predictions across larger areas like catchments or regions even. Of course, there will be a lot of unexplained variation. That's inevitable, small scale variation. And there are maybe ways of dealing with that, like fuzzy classification or Monte Carlo approaches or whatever. I just want to finish off now by thanking Reen on behalf of all of my colleagues, actually, in the Department of Soil Science at the University in Uppsala for your help and encouragement over the years. It's been fantastic for us to be have you with us and to help us out, and it's very much appreciated. I just wanted to endorse everything everyone said yesterday about Reen's openness and helpfulness and willingness to talk and to encourage younger scientists, especially including me. So we wish you all the best for the future from everyone in Uppsala. And I don't know if you recognize that place on the right there, Reen. You do, yeah? It was about 10 years ago now, I think. But we sat there having a meal while my young son was running around. He was 3 years old at the time, but Yeah.
We had a few too
many. Yeah, we did. Yeah. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Any questions from the audience?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a balance. You're always it's a balancing act. I think if you try to refine the tree too much, you end up with too complicated a tree probably. And I think the best way to deal with that uncertainty within classes is probably, I mean, if you're thinking of risk mapping, is maybe a fuzzy approach more, maybe some way. Somehow, not making the tree more complicated, but dealing with the uncertainty that that arises from it. I think that's my feeling right now.
In testing your decision process, wouldn't it be better to just use a cumulative flow under identical hydraulic conditions rather than looking at a breakthrough curve? Doesn't that introduce more uncertainty?
Yeah, I mean, there are different aspects of non-equilibrium flow and transport that, you know, different features of it that you could use to test. And we looked at different, but you need to find something that is in the literature, that there is a big data set that can support that test. And these breakthrough curves are, there's plenty of them out there, we thought. But when we looked at the effect of initial boundary conditions, it narrowed it right down to a small number, actually. But we think we found a way around that we can do a bigger test in the future now. But I don't know if there's enough experimental data on water outflows published. I'm not sure about that, but I think so. And I think also you see macropore flow expressed more clearly in the solute transport than you do in the water flow as well. There is an effect on the water flow, but sometimes it's a little bit, it's smaller than the effect on the solute transport. I think.
Well, Nick, I just wonder if you can translate these observations in more concrete values for fraction mobile water, you know, or beta or something.
Yeah.
And then the mass transfer coefficient. Mm. There was a very interesting study I looked at quite closely by a fellow called Maraca about 10 years ago that he data mined a lot of experiments and looked at the mass transfer.
Uh-huh.
And he clearly showed, well, he didn't mention that, but if you look at this data, that there's an inverse relationship between this alpha and the scale of an experiment.
Yeah.
And so that would, you know, the larger the scale, the smaller the alpha, because you have a larger diffusion length. Mm. The perpendicular coordinate to some extent is the amount of immobile water.
Yeah.
Which clearly is associated, yeah. I would say, with your classes.
Yes.
So
yeah, that is what we are hoping, what we are trying to do, is to relate those classes to then model parameters like alpha and the fraction of mobile, immobile, either in the mobile, immobile, or dual permeability approaches, yes. And we're starting on that now, and the idea is that's the way we would use the scheme, yes, definitely. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let us continue with any further questions to Nick after the session, so in the discussion session. Thank you, Nick. Our next speaker will be Nobuo Toride.